friends, this is Dr. Beter. Today is November 30, 1980, and this is my audio letter number 60. 4 days ago, the New York Daily News published an interesting article about a coming motion picture. It's called The Formula and deals with an international oil conspiracy. And even before seeing the picture, Mobil Oil is reported to be acting very nervous. Supposedly, Mobil is threatening to sue the movie maker, MGM, if Mobil is mentioned in any way. Somehow the whole situation seems to symbolize our situation today. The movie is about oil companies hiding the truth. And at least one real-life oil company would apparently like to hide the movie. Big oil always operates behind a wall of secrecy, deception, and stealth. And in the election just passed, big oil has succeeded for the moment in its grab for the White House. And so, a temporary change of style is brewing in American politics. The Bolsheviks, who have been in power, favor active propaganda to mislead us. By contrast, big oil generally prefers to tell us nothing at all. So as the so-called Reagan administration takes over, we will tend to have a say-nothing government for a while. But whether our government is controlled behind the scenes by big oil or by the Bolsheviks, you and I lose. Because they all operate in the dark, where they cannot be watched. We are living in an age of stealth, and it is leading toward disaster for us all. My three topics this month are: topic number one, the great election surprise of 1980. Topic number two, the planned collapse of America's banking system. And topic number three, the new age of warfare by stealth. Topic number one. For weeks now, Washington has been buzzing about the great election surprise of 1980. Right up to the last minute, all the opinion polls were saying the same thing: too close to call. But when the television networks began their election night coverage, they told a radically different story. 15 minutes after the polls closed on the East Coast, NBC declared the entity Ronald Reagan the winner. On the West Coast, polls were still open, but voters began drifting away. Even more shocking, the alleged President Carter himself conceded defeat less than 2 hours later. West Coast polls still had an hour to go at that point, but many remaining voters just gave up. By then, it was fast becoming clear that voting machines nationwide had registered a landslide in the name of Ronald Reagan. It was an unprecedented state of affairs. The Republican landslide apparently was enormous. And yet, we are told it was a complete surprise. On all sides, political analysts are still rubbing their eyes in disbelief. They're trying out all kinds of excuses to explain why the polls were wrong. Maybe the pocketbook issue did it, they say. Or maybe all those undecided voters before the election were really closet conservatives. Or then again, maybe it was just a plain old protest vote. Or would you believe it was Billy Carter, maybe? My friends, last month I reported that there was one issue that could help defeat the present Bolshevik administration. That was the breakdown of the hostage release ploy just before the election. And it may be that many voters were affected in that way that I mentioned last month. But the apparently surprise landslide was brought about by entirely different means. My friends, it was not the opinion polls that were wrong this time. It was the tally of votes on election day. To bring home what I am about to tell you, I would like to tell you a personal story. It's a story of my own race for the governorship of my home state of West Virginia 12 years ago. The idea that I run for governor came from a political leader in West Virginia. I was then in my 6th year as legal counsel to the United States Export-Import Bank here in Washington. I had been appointed to that position in 1961 by President Kennedy. And apparently, there were those who remembered my efforts in helping Kennedy win in West Virginia in 1960. In any case, I decided to accept the suggestion. On May 1, 1967, I resigned from the Export-Import Bank and returned to my native state of West Virginia. For the next year, I carried out an exhausting grassroots campaign throughout the state. My wife Lily and I went everywhere and spoke to everyone, or so it seemed. There was not a county we missed, and there was hardly a hand that I had not pressed. And from every indication, my campaign was going very well. Then one night, 2 weeks before the election, the telephone rang. When I picked up the telephone, a voice said, "This is so-and-so." I asked what I could do for him, and he replied, "Well, you'd like to have your votes counted, wouldn't you?" Still half asleep, I said, "Of course. What are you talking about?" His answer was, "Well, you know politics is a business. You'd like to have your votes counted, wouldn't you?" By that time, I was wide awake. I replied that there were plenty of county officials and precinct workers to take care of the vote counting. Then I asked him what he was driving at. He said, "Well, in those precincts which have machines, you have to make sure your votes are counted. Don't you understand? This is just how it's done. If you want your votes counted, it'll cost you $250,000. I was flabbergasted, but said I would not pay a cent. I didn't do things like that. At that point, the caller said, "Well, it looks like we can't do any business then," and hung up. After putting the telephone down, I just sat there astonished. My wife, Lily, said, "What was that?" And I told her, "We just lost the election." My friends, in the counties and precincts where old-fashioned paper ballots were used, I did receive votes. But without exception, in every location where voting machines were used, I received no votes, not one single vote. That seemed incredible to me at the time, but I had no evidence, nothing but a telephone call, which I could not prove. Then about 2 weeks after the election, I received a phone call from a Baptist minister. He was asking to meet me because something important had come to his attention. So the next day, I met the minister in a town near Beckley, West Virginia. He had another man with him. The good minister told me that the man with him had asked him, the minister, to forgive him for something he had done to me. The minister had replied that it was not up to him to forgive the man, but up to Mr. Beter. So I asked the minister's friend what it was that he had done to me. And he said, "Mr. Beter, I fixed the voting machines against you." Then he blurted out the whole thing. He said that he was known as a repairman for these machines. But he explained that when he went to the factory school in another state, he was also taught other things. He was taught how to adjust the machinery to record whatever is wanted. For example, voters who pulled the lever for me thought that they were voting for me. But inside the machine was adjusted to transfer the vote to another pre-selected candidate. I could hardly believe my ears. Over a year of grassrooting the state down the drain, and all because of a specialized slot machine known as a voting machine. I asked him why he did such a thing. He answered, "For the money, Mr. Beter. I really need the money." Then he added that he was not the only one, that there were others all over the country doing the same thing. Then he broke down and cried. He said he wanted me to know and to decide if I wanted to forgive him. Really, I felt no revenge, only sorrow for him. And I knew what poverty could do to a person. By this time, all three of us were in tears. I placed my hand on his shoulder and said that I did forgive him. Later, I went to the frauds section of the United States Department of Justice here in Washington. They told me that a governor's race was merely a local matter, so the federal government could not investigate. I also looked into other avenues for possible redress through the courts. But throughout the United States, There have been many cases taken to court over election rigging, and in the end, the courts always do nothing. So ended my governorship race in West Virginia in 1968. I learned the hard way that politics has become a business. In every presidential election since voting machines have been used, there have been charges of voting fraud in certain states. Sometimes more votes are counted than there are registered voters. There are people nicknamed the Lever Brothers in West Virginia who go around and pull the levers before the actual voting begins. There are others who tamper with the machines in their warehouses before they are delivered to the polling places. And there are corrupt officials who know all these things but keep their mouths shut for fear or for money. In audio letter number one, I reviewed some of the background of voting machines. My friends, this is very important. Voting machines are not regulated in any way. They were developed from slot machines, and they were controlled at first by organized crime. But then, long ago, they were absorbed into the hands of the Rockefeller cartel, as I detailed in audio letter number one. And in the secret struggle over the election, which I reported last month, voting machines were the decisive secret weapon. For the moment, they have carried the day for the Rockefeller oil cartel. As the voting began on November 4, 1980, the entity President Carter was in Plains, Georgia to vote. Reporters on the scene said later that he almost broke down and cried as he spoke to townspeople, because the outcome was already known before the voting began. That is also the reason for the unprecedented concession an hour before West Coast polls closed. Word had reached the White House only the day before about what was going to happen. There was massive fixing of voting machines in nine states: New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, Texas, and California. The machines were also fixed, but on a less complete scale, in Indiana and Missouri. In addition, there was selective fixing of machines in key districts of more than 20 other states. It was all over before it started. The opinion polls beforehand were actually far more accurate than the voting tallies on election day. Opinion polls can be fixed too, but in this case, they were not. All the polls found a general apathy about the candidates, dissatisfaction with all of them. And that apathy was reflected by the low turnout on election day. In spite of good weather nationwide, the turnout was the lowest in 30 years. That spells apathy, my friends, and apathy does not create landslides. Instead, apathy about candidates leads to a flip-the-coin attitude. Heads, it is candidate A. Tails, it's candidate B. Both candidates, or in this case, both major candidates, just about split the vote. So apathy leads to a very close race, just as the polls predicted. But thanks to fixable voting machines, a landslide was created out of thin air. Last month, I reported some of the factors pointing to a last-minute election surprise. As I explained then, it's a mild setback for the Bolsheviks here. Right now, Big Oil is preparing to run the country with a free hand. The figurehead called Reagan is being programmed to behave like a new Eisenhower, delegating everything to agents of Big Oil. But the Bolsheviks here are working fast. They're in a hurry to seize control of the so-called Reagan team themselves. Once that happens, the so-called Reagan era may end abruptly. The Reagan image is tailored to fit the corporate socialist plans of Big Oil. So the Bolsheviks will prefer a new face, a new figurehead, to program their own way. And so, someday sooner than you think, we Americans may be in for a shock. We will be told that the entity President Reagan has met with an unfortunate accident or a sudden fatal illness. Then we will be seeing a new face, saying new things. The face will seem to be that of George Bush, speaking from Washington. But his words will come straight from Bolshevik headquarters in New York City. And that, my friends, will be the last and greatest surprise in the stolen election of 1980. Topic number two. Last month, I gave you suggestions for an awful lot to do. I offered you not one, but two major steps in our action plan to save America. Action step four, you will recall, involves another letter to Senator William Proxmire. And it's the most important so far in spite of the election results, because this Proxmire letter is an important weapon as we open up the second front in our battle. In action step five, I outlined how we can do this. We're going to the very heart of America's banking system, the privately owned Federal Reserve System. This month, my friends, I want to give you a breather. It's vitally important that you follow through on the things I suggested last month. So I want to make sure that you have enough time to do all those things. The letters which I have urged you to write to the Federal Reserve System are more important than you can imagine. So in spite of the holidays, I ask you, please, write those letters as soon as possible. Nothing less than our survival as a nation is at stake. Let me mention one footnote to my suggestions of last month. If you should have any trouble getting the names of the Federal Reserve officials from your bank, don't give up. You can call the Federal Reserve Bank in your region and ask for the library. Ask the librarian for the names of the president, the officers, and all the directors. Several listeners have already done this and got the names without any difficulty. Beyond this, I would make no new suggestions for what you can do this month. But I do want to take a few moments to remind you where we are heading if we do not act. We are once again watching interest rates explode like bombs on the American economy. And on all sides, we're hearing about the disastrous effects which are coming in automobiles, construction, and business in general. Already it appears that Chrysler might go under. And when financial analysts mention this, they say in the same breath a forbidden word, depression. But, my friends, interest rates are not the only way in which America's major banks are leading us into a depression with inflation. America's banking system itself is becoming shakier by the day. The seeds of trouble have been there for many years now. They are all related to the grand design to destroy our money and our economy. It's the same grand design which involved the theft of America's monetary gold supply. But the process began speeding up nearly 2 years ago in early 1979. That was when the Bolsheviks here staged their hidden coup d'etat against the Rockefellers. In audio letter 44 for March 1979, I gave my listeners an early warning about this process. I explained how the stage was being set for a collapse of America's entire banking system, and I revealed that the failure of the giant Chase Manhattan Bank may well trigger it all. For various reasons, many people considered my warning about the banks just too incredible to believe at that time. But just like the coming nuclear war, the coming bank collapse is now coming closer to the surface. And as it does so, danger signals are inevitably showing up here and there. For example, Fortune magazine recently said, and I quote, "There can be no doubt that banking is entering a period of crisis. In one way or another, the industry's troubles could lead to the passing of many banks, perhaps including some of the biggest and most prestigious," unquote. And 4 months ago, at the end of July 1980, the Christian Science Monitor carried two page one reports about the situation. They focused attention on the disastrous new act, which I told you about last month, the so-called Monetary Control Act of 1980. It pointed out that the act has drastically reduced the ratio of insurance reserves to savings. There is now only about a penny to back up every dollar you have in a bank or savings and loan savings account. The collapse of just a few large banks could wipe out the whole savings insurance system. And if that happens, my friends, collapsing confidence will bring down America's entire banking system. The second special article in the Monitor contained a hint at something even more basic. It said, quote, "The sleeper monetary provisions of the Act continue to nag at gold and precious metals-oriented conservatives. They see the danger that the Fed, an administration facing a possible bank crash at some point, might throw the doors open to hyperinflation of the United States economy." Unquote. My friends, those are exactly the stakes I was warning you about last month. There is no gold to back up the Federal Reserve IOUs, which we use as money. The Federal Reserve System is claiming assets which do not exist. Those who have conspired to destroy our money have planned all along to bring on a bank crash. They want the banks to collapse when the time is right, but they don't want you to know what is happening. They dare not let you know the truth about our missing gold. And so, certain key Treasury and Federal Reserve officials are meeting right now to plan a counterattack against our preventive war of truth. As always, their plan is to use the big lie. And as you know, they were liars from the beginning, and they are liars now. It is a lie, my friends, that the Treasury today holds 270 million ounces of Federal Reserve gold in its vaults. That's what Treasury and Federal Reserve books show. But those books are a complete fraud, a lie, and more people are having doubts about it. But there is an old psychological trick that is about to be used on us all. That trick is, if people start to suspect a lie, make the lie even bigger. Most people are taken completely off guard by this technique. If a lie becomes big enough, people think it has to be the truth. No one, we think, would have enough nerve to tell a lie that big. So here is a trick that is now being planned. Right now, our gold reserves are officially valued at the old official price of $42.22 per ounce. That's the price reflected in the gold stock listings by the Treasury and Federal Reserve balance sheets, which I discussed last month. But watch for the non-existent gold reserves to be revalued at current market prices. In terms of dollars, our fictitious gold reserves will suddenly look 15 or 20 times bigger. The plan is also to capitalize on talk in Congress about returning to the gold standard. First, the controlled major media will publicize talk about the gold standard idea. Then will come the spectacular gold revaluation publicity stunt. Finally, any return to a true gold standard will quietly be squashed because we don't really have all that gold. Instead, they are trying to devise some trick which will require only a token amount of gold. What that will be has not yet been decided, but the net result will be powerful propaganda to impress people to believe the big lie about America's alleged giant gold hoard. My friends, many people would rather put their head in the sand about our missing gold. They would rather not know the awful truth. That is exactly why the big lie will work with so many people. But that is like having cancer and not wanting to be told about it. Because the United States dollar has terminal cancer, and it will die soon if the truth about our missing gold remains hidden. Sometimes my enemies argue that the truth about our missing gold should not be revealed. According to their argument, exposure of the truth about our missing gold will itself bring down our economy. But, my friends, that argument says that a lie is better than the truth. And it is wrong, dead wrong, and here's why. If the scandal of America's missing gold breaks into the open, it can well set the stage for international action to prevent disaster. There could be an immediate international monetary conference to resolve the crisis. The hidden power of the Bolsheviks here, who are bent on disaster, would be broken by the gold scandal. So the conference could put an end to the disastrous system of floating currencies now in effect. Instead, they could establish a new system of fixed yet flexible rates of exchange, which would be stable. At the same time, the conference should fix interest rates on an international basis. That would tend to stop the worldwide interest rate war now going on to attract hot money from one country to another. With the pressure off interest rates, inflation could be controlled and industry could revive. Inflation is international in scope. And because the gold scandal here is international in scope, it could be investigated on an international basis. There would be a real chance of tracking down our gold and tracking down the people who have done this to us. Meanwhile, there could be a kind of Marshall Plan in reverse to save the United States dollar. To tide us over the crisis, foreign central banks could lend us some gold for international transactions. Why should they bother to do that, you ask? Very simple. Our trading partners have hundreds of billions of dollars in their hands. If the dollar goes, so do their own economies. So it is in their own self-interest to take international action to save the dollar. But, my friends, all that can happen only, and I repeat, only, if the gold scandal breaks before the coming bank crash. Because that is the only way to set our monetary affairs free of the grasp of the Bolsheviks here. If they can keep the gold scandal undercover for just a little longer, they will get their way. They will win. And, my friends, you and I will lose everything.